all mountains. We should have the sort of thing they're attempting to do with bulldozers in the Hollywood Hills, to the destruction of the ecology, in ghastly fulfillment of the biblical prophecy that every mountain, every valley should be exalted, and every mountain laid low, and the rough places made plain. And I'm sorry to say it was Isaiah to whom this temple is dedicated, who made that remark. But the same Isaiah also said something that at least Christians do not often quote, which is this following sentence: I am the Lord and there is none else. I form the light and create the darkness. I make peace and I create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. In spite of which, everybody is busy trying to be good, not realizing that we would not recognize saints unless there were sinners, or sages unless there were fools. And there is no way out of that dilemma. That is why Buddhism represents existence in terms of a wheel called the Bhava Chakra, the wheel of becoming, of birth and death. And on the top of that wheel, there are Deva people, whom we would call angels. And at the bottom of the wheel, there are Naraka, or tormented people, in purgatory. And you go round and round, now this way, now that way. It's really like a squirrel cage, where you're running and running and running to get to the top. And yet, you have to run faster and faster to stay where you are. And that's why there is always the sense of the more you succeed in any scale of either worldly or spiritual progress, the more you have the haunting feeling that you're still in the same place. So you think, now there must be some way out of that. Perhaps there's something ambitious and proud and wrong in aspiring to be enlightened or compassionate. Perhaps there's a great dose of spiritual pride in that, that I, by my efforts, could make myself into a Buddha or a saint. And therefore, perhaps the thing to do is to try to eliminate all desire. Not only the desire for worldly success, but likewise the desire for spiritual success. For the Buddha proposed that desire was the root of suffering, and therefore suggested to his hearers that if they eliminated desire or clinging, they might cease from suffering. But you must realize that the so-called teachings of the Buddha are not doctrines in the sense that the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims have doctrines. They are proposals. They are the opening steps in a dialogue. And if you go away and try not to desire in any way, you will very quickly discover that you are desiring not to desire. And so we very rapidly come to a situation where you discover that with regard to your own transformation, everything you try to do about it doesn't work. It may have some sort of temporary success to make you feel better, but again and again you come back to the same old gnawing problem. And that is why people interested in spiritual things tend to move from one sect to another, from one teacher to another, always hoping that they will meet one who has the answer. Of course, then, there are many teachers who say, indeed, there is nothing you can do. And therefore, you have to practice non-doing, as the Taoists call it, wu wei, non-striving. But then you find in turn that it's extraordinarily difficult not to strive. It's like trying not to think of a green elephant. and immediately you think of it. And so you come to the dismal conclusion that you can neither achieve what you want to achieve, that is to say, liberation from the alternation of the opposites by striving, nor can you achieve it by not striving. And thereby you have learned that you cannot concentrate on purpose. It's like trying to be unself-conscious on purpose, or to be genuine on purpose, or to love on purpose. When you say, I ought to love, well, that puts you in a double bind. When we say of a person, well, he's trained himself to be deliberately unself-conscious, or he has very disciplined spontaneity. But what we were looking for was somebody whose spontaneity was genuine, so that the scaffolding didn't show. And we believe that there are such people, like children, but they don't know how interesting they are. And when they find out, they become brats. Imagine for a moment that it was your privilege to have a brief interview with God, in the course of which you were allowed to ask one question. What would you ask? Now, you would have to think this over very carefully, because this golden opportunity would come to you only once, and you would have to be most careful that you didn't ask a silly question. Well, you might try God out with a Zen Buddhist koan, such as, beyond the positive and the negative, what is reality? And the Lord would turn to you and say, my dear child, your question has no meaning. And you wouldn't have the opportunity to think up a meaningful one and come back. So perhaps you should have asked, what question should I ask? And the Lord would say to you, why do you want a question? See, it seems you do want one, don't you? Because you feel that something is wrong if you don't have a problem. Well, you've got one. That is the insoluble problem of trying to win without losing. Now, as long as you can keep that problem, you'll be busy. Only, however, until you see that it can't be solved. But there are all sorts of ways of presenting that problem in such a way that you cannot see that it's meaningless. And the better gurus are very clever at bringing these ways out. You may see, for example, if you are invited to practice intense concentration, that after a while you find yourself thinking about concentrating, and therefore that your concentration is somewhat divided. Or he may ask you, why are you concentrating? What is your motivation for this activity? And you find out that it's your element of irreducible rascality. So, however, the teacher, once he's seen that we've mastered that lesson, has something still more ingenious. He says, now, you've actually made progress, because finding out that you could not really concentrate was valuable because it began to prick the illusion of your ego. But you've only got your foot in at the door. Beyond this are many, many higher things to be learned, and you must redouble your efforts. And so, of course, you apply yourself all the more, again and again, on all sorts of tricks that these old gentlemen can come out with. And you will keep at it just as long as he can make you fall for it. But in the end, you see that it was all tricks. As the great Zen master Rinzai said, well, after all, there was nothing much in Obaku's Buddhism. And he went on to explain to his students that the art of Zen, or teaching Zen, is like deceiving a child with an empty fist. You know how you can intrigue a child by pretending you've got something very precious in your fist. And you can play a game for an hour, provoking the child to ever greater enthusiasm to find out what you've got. And in the end, the revelation is that there was nothing there. So many people say, in the course of their Zen training, I realized there was nothing to realize. It was all there from the beginning. Because you see, standing opposite to the realization that you can't do anything about it, and equivalently that you can't do nothing about it, comes, of course, the awakening that the reason for that is there is no you separate from you. In other words, when you try to control your thoughts or control your feelings, there is no difference between the thoughts and the controller. Because what you call the thinker is simply your thought of yourself. The thinker is a thought among thoughts, and the feeler is a feeling among feelings. And trying to control thoughts with thoughts is like trying to bite your own teeth. So you found that out. Well, then the other side of the picture is, of course, that if you do find that out, you discover that the project of controlling yourself was unnecessary, because you were yourself a Buddha from the very beginning. That's what the Upanishads mean when they say quite simply, tattvamasi. You're it. You, as you are. Now, how can you conceive that? Supposing you let your imagination go and really think through what you would like to happen. Imagine the most gorgeous state of bliss that you can conceive, where there are no worries, no anxiety, no haunting future with unpleasant consequences. You're in control of the whole works, and you're sitting on your lotus, perfectly content. And I ask you seriously, is that really what you want? Are you quite sure that's what you want? Imagine now, let's get this situation straight. You've got everything you want. You're in the highest possible spiritual state that you can conceive. And yet, I haven't really surrendered myself, because I know it all. Something I don't know. So please, the surprise. You know what would happen? You would find yourself sitting here in this building tonight, feeling exactly the way you feel. There's your answer. Because after all, don't you have it all? Look, you have the feeling of yourself. But the feeling of self depends on there being at the same time a contrast, the feeling of other. The self has a certain sensation of being in control of life to some extent through voluntary action. The will seems to have a certain freedom. And yet, on the other hand, there are limits to that. And it seems in the end, life sweeps us away and we are overwhelmed by the involuntary. And yet, the voluntary keeps popping up. New voluntaries come into the world with every baby. So you see, you couldn't have the experience you call being a voluntarily acting self without the contrast of the involuntary happening. Now, do you want to be without the involuntary happening? You want to get rid of that? All right. If you get rid of it, you won't have the experience of the voluntary self. Or would you like to turn it the other way around? Would you like to have the experience of no voluntary self? And on the other hand, everything just happened. Well, then you say, well, I'm not sure about that. Because then I would feel at first that I was floating. See, that I had no further responsibilities, that I was just walking on air. And we do get that feeling sometimes. If you take the ideas of determinism and fatalism to their final conclusion, you do have that sense of freedom from all responsibility, freedom from worry and care. And you float along for a while, but it wears off. You don't somehow seem to be able to follow out that philosophy consistently, especially if you have children. And somehow a society begins to push on you to be responsible, as it pushes on children to be responsible. And so this nagging duality keeps coming back, that I cannot realize the nice irresponsible condition of involuntary behavior unless I have the contrast of the possibility of the voluntary, and vice versa. Now, what does that mean? Obviously, it means that these two aspects or sides of our experience, which we can call the voluntary and the involuntary, the knower and the known, the subject and the object, the self and the other, although appearing to be two, are indeed one. Because you can't have one without the other. And when that state of affairs arises, you know at once that there's a conspiracy. That two things which look as different can be are for that very reason the same. Now, you can detect even under those actions of yours which you call voluntary, the voluntary movement of the muscles or of the mind, that there are processes which are not voluntary. You do not will your blood to circulate. You do not control by intention the synapses in your nervous system. And yet you would be incapable of any voluntary action unless those involuntary processes were going on. So you see these two things go together. And you begin to realize something which is rather difficult to describe, that what you call your experience is a do happening. We don't have good words for this. We have some words which have this sort of sense, like the word cleave, which means to stick together or to hold together and also to split. And the word sucker in Latin means holy and accursed. And so I would like to propose we all should find some word for a do happening, because it's all a do happening. That's what Buddhists mean when they talk about karma. The word karma means action. And when something happens to you, be it good or bad, they say it is your karma. That means, quite simply, it is your doing. But you say, I didn't mean to do that. No. One school of thought will explain it by saying, but you see, you did something in a former life or at a former time, which now has this consequence. But that's a very superficial understanding of karma. You don't need to believe in reincarnation to understand karma. Karma is simply that you don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. that with one aspect you are doing what you call the environment, and with the other aspect you are doing what you call the organism, the me, this living body.